The Science Inside Podcast.
This is The Science Inside.
Hello and welcome to The Science Inside. We are still charting the field of science and technology in South Africa, and we are doing that by interviewing great women and men who are doing exceptional work in their various fields of science, tech, and innovation. And tonight is no exception. We have on The Science Inside a molecular biologist, Thulile Khanyile, on the line, and she is a very dynamic woman. She is a lecturer, a social entrepreneur, and a PhD candidate in the HIV Pathogenesis Research Unit in the School of Pathology here at the University of the Witwatersrand. And during her master's, she worked in the field of biophotonics, where she was examining the use of lasers for precision delivery of antiretroviral drugs in cell culture. And now, for her PhD studies, she is searching for an HIV vaccine that can mimic the broadly neutralizing antibody response of the donor CAP256, which is the super responder in small animal models. Now, I know we've been talking to a lot of these researchers in the field of science, but this is really interesting to find out the various kind of works that they are doing by looking for vaccines and doing research into this epidemic. Thulile is a multidimensional woman as well. She likes helping other people, particularly young people, and she's been able to do this through her non-profit organization called Nkathuto Edu Propeller, which is self-explanatory, really. It means take or choose education. The NPO was established to advocate for science education and promotion, innovation, and entrepreneurship within previously disadvantaged communities. We will get into conversation with Thulile a bit later on in the show, but on science tonight, we are looking into how our memories are stored, how they are made, and why the least important memory will pop up in the most unlikely situation at times when you are not really looking for those kind of memories. Then, of course, we wrap up our chat with Thulile, where we talk about her personal life and what are the other interesting things that she gets up to when she's not wearing a white coat and when she is not in a lab. But for now, we get into the news with Mulebohe Mukoka. Welcome to The Science Inside once more, Mulebo.
Thank you for having me. Second time in a row.
Yeah, that's really lovely. So can you tell us what is on the news for tonight?
Okay. In your news-making headlines this week, the future of energy in South Africa may depend on a mix of energy sources in combating climate change, and a secretary bid in Stellenbosch has now become more than a new leg to stand on.
This week's science headline.
Good evening, I'm Mulebohe Mukoka. Now, the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research's head of Energy Center, Dr. Clinton Carter Brown, recently delivered an energy transition presentation to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Energy and Mineral Resources, where he spoke about how South Africa can introduce a more sustainable energy transition though coal will remain part of the energy mix well into 2050. Now, this strategy is just one of the efforts to curb carbon emissions and to stop the depletion of limited natural resources. Carter Brown elaborates.
The challenging one in that, I think the true understanding of challenges have really only started to materialize in the last 10 years. And, you know, as a developing economy, price or the cost of energy is a major consideration. So when there's been a discourse around, you know, we want to reduce emissions, that's going to come at a cost without a clear understanding of how that is going to be financed and, you know, is a real challenge. What is now a real game changer is that as we need to decommission some of the old coal stations, the lowest cost replacement alternatives are inherently cleaner renewable energy sources. So, you know, what we're seeing now is a major opportunity to create new industries and to decarbonize portions of the energy system. And what is getting a lot of traction now is that in doing that, we can actually reduce the cost increase trajectory. So being cleaner is no longer in conflict with being cheaper. And, you know, until as recently as 5 years ago, that wasn't the case. There's a lot of discourse now in terms of decarbonization, especially given that we've got opportunities to do so without necessarily increasing our cost.
Now, South Africa's domestic electricity supply is subject to the supply of coal and faces multiple challenges ranging from a growing infrastructure backlog, aging and poorly performing coal-fired power stations, and a dependence on important liquid fuels. A case in point being when Cyclone Idai struck the shores of Mozambique, South Africa was left largely due to Eskom being forced to implement load shedding in order to preserve the little fuel available. Carter Brown emphasized the need for this transition as it not only leads to power shortages, but also to reduce investor confidence, inflation in the rand-dollar exchange, an increasingly constrained national electricity system, and an escalation in electricity prices, which affects the competitiveness of South African industry.
It's highly feasible, and we've already got a very successful program. South Africa has already procured a lot of renewable energy, and it's already integrated into the system, and a lot more can be done. So there are challenges around what we call the just energy transition. What essentially means is that some areas of the country, in Mpumalanga, where a lot of the coal mines and coal-fired power stations are located, that there's going to be a localized impact in those communities. So as one starts to decommission those power stations and those mines, one needs to then find alternatives in terms of for those economies and to an extent those miners and power station workers. And that's where, you know, a lot of the thinking now needs to be around this just transition in terms of what are the options to develop the necessary plans, the social plans to ensure that the new renewable energy or whatever it is that gets built, it's not just renewable energy, it's gas and other sources, that we'll be able to create those technologies and create new jobs and new opportunities. But it needs to be well managed because of the, you know, the profound impacts that this will have in certain locations and on labor. So, you know, one needs to have a plan, and this concept of a just transition is gaining a lot of momentum.
Now, the transition into a possible future with a power mix is characterized by a variety of energy sources such as solar, wind, hydro, natural gas and biomass, the mass of living biological organisms in an ecosystem, which may include microorganisms, plants or animals as fuels. In order to realize the National Development Plan Vision 2030, coal will continue to play a major role for at least the next 30 years or so, depending on the decline of its use being paramount importance.
It will be many years before the entire electricity system is termed to be coal-free. I mean, we're only now completing the Medupi and Kasiba power plants, and those are expected to be, you know, an economic life of anything up to 50 years, possibly longer. So there will be some coal in the South African power system for quite some time, unless there is a call an accelerated decarbonisation plan, which means that even though it's going to cost us more, we are prepared to early decommission coal fleet. And today, there's no such plan on the table nationally. The present, what we call sort of least cost trajectories, are where there's existing coal stations and they're operating acceptably to keep them in the system. And as such, from our analysis and the Department of Energy's own plans, we really only start to see coal in the energy's electricity system start to decline quite substantially from about 2030. And even in 2050, there will still be a small amount of coal. So it's going to be a gradual decline that we expect to see. And anything more aggressive than that will come at some kind of cost premium, which may still be attractive to the country in terms of the new jobs and the other opportunities that it will create.
Carter Brown explains that South African low-cost renewable sources could also provide opportunities to export green hydrogen and carbon-neutral synthetic liquid fuels to markets overseas and generate new forms of income, jobs and industries.
Electricity in South Africa is traditionally or historically been relatively cheap because of the low-cost coal-fired power stations, and those costs are increasing. So even with the most economic portfolio projects implemented, the bulk costs of electricity are expected to continue to increase for the next 10 years, not at the sorts of levels that consumers are presently experiencing, because a lot of the present cost increases is really through the increase of the cost overruns and time overruns on the Eskom Medupi and Kusile power plant, the main driver behind the cost increases. But in the long run, we really see an opportunity where South Africa is strategically positioned to have some of the lowest cost electricity in the world once again, as it had in the sort of 1980s and 90s and 2000s. So because we have such good solar and wind resources in the country, we really do have the opportunity to, in the long run, reduce electricity prices. But in the medium term, there will still be some pain in terms of price increases before we start to stabilize and then ultimately decrease the cost of electricity.
Now, moving on to our final story, a sanctuary bird called Legs has become the first animal in South Africa to be fitted with a 3D printed prosthesis. The leg, which is more of a stump rather, was created by a team of prosthetics and orthotists from a company called Bunnycorp, who focuses in addition manufacturing growth in the medical sector, specializing in human and animal prosthetics products and services. Now in 2017, a captured bird at a zoo in Germany was one of the very first in the world to be fitted with one. But for South Africa, it was for the first time that a national bird was fitted with a 3D printed prosthetic leg, which saw this bird testing its new fitment a week after its new leg. One of the 3D printing experts at Bunnycorp, rather, Philip van der Walt.
I've been working in this technology for many, many years. A lot of the industries are slowly adapting towards it, seeing the potential that it can do. And especially with animals, a big problem is there isn't really products available on the market. So the few things that are out there is not really suitable for use. In this case, for people would end up using a piece of pipe or whatever just to kind of simulate something, but it's not a proper solution. And the 3D printing allows us to really do custom geometries, custom shapes that just functions better than anything else. Material is very important because we're looking at weight to strength ratio, which means we don't want something that's going to be too heavy, but it needs to be strong. And especially in this case where this is a wild animal and they use their feet to kick their prey, so it's quite a hard knock that they hit with. So we had to make sure that we have got something very strong. So the material that we used was a carbon fiber printing material. We are currently experimenting with various types of materials, strong materials, to see what works best versus the weight and so on. So we might be doing another leg or two different materials just to see if it would work better or not, or how long it would last, that type of thing. But yeah, material does play a big role.
Now, this was the same team involved in the recent development of the world's first 3D printed middle ear bones in the world, first transplanting of 3D printed middle ear bones by Professor Mashadu Chifalaru of the University of Pretoria. The bird, which has been a resident of Encounters Wildlife Rehabilitation and Conservation Center near Stellenbosch for 4 years now, was brought to the rehabilitation center after badly injuring and sustaining an infection after its foot was trapped in a snare, resulting to its amputation. Nevertheless, this was not the end for Legs. Last year, aviation veterinarian of the Center for Aviation, Reptile and Exotics, Dr. Kuzi van der Beer, opted to give Legs another shot at life and summoning the 3D printing design team to Bunnycorp to interview, and the rest is history.
We actually 3D scanned the existing leg or the stump, so we had to make something that fits really, really perfectly, and also that's going to be very strong and light. And 3D printing was just very convenient to do it like that, because we can do things that we cannot do with any other types of manufacturing.
Now, Legs has quickly adjusted to her new artificial limbs. The stump has been fitted with draining holes to ensure comfortability and health. She's already strutting around, showing off her new leg and putting it to good use.
We get regular updates. The owner, they check on him on a regular basis, and as well as the vet, Dr. The Bear. They constantly let us know if there's anything changing or anything. But so far, it looks very good. And all the results look very promising. We would like to end up with a leg that he can wear, not indefinitely, but something that he can wear for a long period of time without them having to check it the whole time, you know. But it's tricky because design we did, we tried something. We added draining holes and air holes as well to make sure that there's no water that gets stuck in the inside of the leg, because if there's water and moisture, then eventually that could develop into something. But with this, the leg should be dry the whole time, which means there shouldn't be any issues like that. But they're constantly checking to make sure that everything is positive.
Now let's recap your stories for this week. Now, the future of energy in South Africa may depend on a mix of energy sources in combating climate change, and a secretary bed in Stellenbosch now has more than a new leg to stand on. This week's news stories were sourced from the CSIR and the ScienceDaily.com and the CSIR website.
This week's Science Headline.
Welcome back. You're still on the Science Inside, and on the line tonight, we have molecular biologist Thulile Khanyile of the University of the Witwatersrand, and she's a lecturer here at Wits and a PhD candidate in the study of HIV pathogenesis research unit in the School of Pathology. And during her master's, she worked in the field of biophotonics, examining the use of lasers for precision delivery of antiretroviral drugs in cell culture. Now, in her PhD study, she is in search of a vaccine that can mimic the broadly neutralizing antibody response of the donor CAP256, a super responder in small animal models. And she is on the line. She's going to be explaining that further in this interview. Good evening and a very warm welcome to the Science Inside, Thulile.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I understand that science was not really your first career choice, but then your parents somehow managed to convince you into taking up the sciences, and they basically just turned your thoughts and your plans around. Take us through that journey and that decision making.
I think, you know, when growing up and you're at school, you know, it's that time where you could be good at more than one thing, right? So I had I still have quite an interest for the arts. So drawing, singing, poetry, writing, creative writing, all of that. I really have a very strong side and a strong interest in that. But I also just like the human body from a medical perspective as well. From a medical perspective, so what I wanted to do was become a medical doctor as a result of being deterred from the creative spaces.
Yeah.
Because my parents were like, the reality of the matter for them is that, well, they just want to know that I can do something that's going to give me an income, that's going to make me steady. And for them, going into the arts or pursuing the arts didn't seem lucrative for them at the time. You know, so they sort of wanted to redirect me into a different space, and because I was getting sort of the marks, I thought, actually, you know what, let me do medicine. Which ended up not happening, thank goodness. But you know, that's how it sort of all happened, you know.
Yes. And I also spoke to your previous professor, Professor Shirley Mutaung, and you know, she spoke about you being her protege and, you know, being like her understudy. But she really spoke really well about you, about how hardworking you were and how inspiring you really are. But how would you say your experience and your studies from TUT have brought you to where you are in your career and has evolved over the years?
I think for me, being at TUT was interesting because being at a university of technology, you sort of get the perception that there's going to be a lot of theory. I mean, there's going to be a lot of practice all the time, practical work all the time.
Yeah.
But I actually didn't find that was the case. But the answer is that it was very theoretical. You know, when I was doing my undergrad in biotechnology at TUT, as well as my bachelor of technology as well, very theoretical. What was different is that I could have that year of in-service training where I would then be in industry. And I was very strategic about that. I did quite a lot of research to find out what I liked doing, and I had decided that I liked research. While still an undergrad, I knew I liked research. I just didn't know what field of research I wanted to go into.
Yes.
But then I heard of the CSIR, and for my in-service training while at TUT, which you need to graduate, I sort of targeted the CSIR. And for me, if I hadn't been at TUT, if I hadn't been at a University of Technology, I would have not had that exposure.
Yeah.
So how TUT then lends itself to me finding where I am now is that I was groomed, I would say I was groomed at the CSIR as a researcher. So being at the CSIR as an in-service trainee, I sort of tried to work very hard and try to be very handy with the researchers that I was working with at the time, who were far more experienced than I was. And they saw value in grooming me to a point where I did my master's still at the CSIR and then exposed to the university to a point where I'm not working at the university. So really, I think it's because that helps me become relevant in my life. It's that there's that 1 year that you have to spend in industry. And for me, that's how I ended up where I am today.
Yes. And how was, how difficult was it actually landing a job at the CSIR?
What I've learned, landing a job at the CSIR is hard.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing to do. However, I think over the years, what I've learned is that there's a way that you connect with people, and there's a way that you're able to tell people who you are and what you do, mostly who you are, by showing them who you are.
Mm.
That makes them have an interest in you, which makes things that would otherwise be difficult slightly more accessible to you.
Yes. But
I don't know if that makes any sense.
I hear you. But then you say it was quite difficult, penetrating that workplace. But then you left, and then here you are, you are at WITS. Why was there that shift from, working at this research institution, and then now you are here at WITS, you are lecturing, on the other side you are doing research, and at the same time you are, studying?
When the opportunity to go to join the university came, I had been at the CSIR already for about 4 years. And I think as a person that went to the CSIR in my early 20s, going to my mid-20s, I felt like I had explored the CSIR enough for my age.
Mm.
And I was in a position where I could move somewhere else to continue doing research. Because remember, a big bulk of my job description at the university, a big bulk of it is actually still doing research. So following on getting my PhD, I still have to do research, which is what I will be doing at the CSIR in any case. It's just that now there's the additional role of lecturing, and the additional role of having to serve the community as an academic. So for me, I think it was the right progression, which I never really planned for. I can't remember there being a time where I said, one day I'm going to go be a lecturer.
Mm.
No, that didn't happen for me at all. It was just that the opportunity came, and it came at the right time. And I think I was prepared for it, and I was ready for it, and I was willing to take the jump.
Well, and it's quite interesting, because then you did not buy yourself off from, exploring, because somebody else would have thought, now going back to deal with students and doing this and that would have been a challenge. But your PhD study, it's looking into finding a vaccine that resembles HIV, but one that is unable to infect the individual, but ultimately they have the ability to neutralize various different strains of HIV. This is very, very interesting research. Tell us more about this.
So the essence, this is how I like to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
I say that if you get the flu, without taking medication, your body, your immune system, sort of knows how to resist itself off the flu.
Mm.
In the event of HIV, our bodies are not equipped to do that. Our bodies don't know how to completely fight or neutralize the virus.
Yes.
Which means we have to teach the immune system how to do this. So we have to expose the immune system to something that looks like HIV so that the immune system sort of launches a response against this thing and it remembers for next time what it looked like so that when it's exposed to the new HIV, it knows how to respond. Challenge with HIV is your immune system launches a response and HIV mutates or changes. If you think about how, if you think of HIV as a shape or as a puzzle piece, and you think of the immune system developing these soldiers, which we call antibodies, and these antibodies fit into the virus, and that's how it neutralizes, right, as a puzzle piece. But if this HIV is constantly changing, it means that the immune system needs to change the puzzle piece that's going to fit into the new shape of the HIV.
Yeah.
And HIV changes shape so often that the body ends up not being able to fight it at all until the HIV wins and progresses to AIDS, and that leads obviously to death.
Yeah.
Now, what we have to do is develop a vaccine that is able to keep up with the changing or the evolution of HIV in an infected person. Right? And a couple of years ago, a cohort of people, it was discovered that approximately 20% of the people infected with HIV are able to, in fact, keep up with the changes that the HIV virus makes in the body. And what we're trying to do now is to mimic that response.
Wow.
So this donor, CAP256, we harvested the antibodies and the virus, the sequence of the virus that makes up the shape that changes, was harvested at different time points. So that now we're able to use the sequences of the virus that were harvested from CAP256 as the baseline for a vaccine regimen.
Wow. That is...
So what we're trying to do now is to see if that works by testing them in animal models.
So this is almost like how the flu vaccine would work, but on a more elevated level, if I may put it?
Sure. So I mean, the research is showing that it's like, I think it's HPV, the human papillomavirus.
Yes.
Where you get multiple shots. It's also a vaccine, but I think you get three shots. You have to present at the hospital three times to get vaccinated. So for HIV as well, it would have to be a similar case, where you could take a vaccine for the flu, but it's just one shot. So with HIV, you may have to take multiple shots. So you may have to take multiple shots, which are different variants of shots that look like the virus but are not the virus.
Yes, because obviously
the immune system wants to remember. Yeah.
Wow, that is really interesting. I've never heard of somebody actually explaining the process of how, you know, HIV mutates and evolves over time in the way that you have explained it. But just to wrap up this part of the show or of the interview, who are the people who have inspired you, and who are the people you know who are inspiring you within your field?
Sure. In my field, the very first person I was exposed to was Professor Makubetsa Kati, and that chap inspired me a lot. He was the one that was my boss when I was at the CSIR. And my current boss, Maria Papadana Sao Paulos, is a great inspiration as well. People like Helen Rees, Glenda Gray, Yolene Marses, that I've been working on HIV for a long time. Those people inspire me quite a lot, from both an academic perspective and both as just scientists, and just the appetite for for feeding inquiry.
Yeah.
For something that's really relevant and affects a lot of people, particularly where we find ourselves, you know, in the global community.
And you are definitely that acquiring mind, because from the various people that I've spoken to, you're somebody who doesn't stop at one point and you say, this is enough. You just go on and on and on, seeking knowledge, seeking to better yourself. But we will talk to you a bit later in the show. Right now we are going into Unsigned, so please do not drop the phone. And speaking of memories, Thulile Khanyile was speaking about how they are trying to mimic the HIV, RNA, or the RNA within HIV, so that it remembers, so that your body can sort of help treat itself. But now in Unscience, we are looking into something very similar. And this week's Unscience was produced by myself.
Unusual. Unlikely. Unscience.
Mulebogeng. Now this is that part of our show where we get a little bit silly with the research that we discover on various websites that pertain to science and tech. So imagine you walk into a room full of people. A few moments later, your friend walks straight up to you and introduces two friends of theirs to you. And now, later on, it's dinner time, and now you're sitting across the very same people at the dinner table. But you need at least just one of them to pass the salt to you. But for some reason, you can't remember their names. And no matter how hard you try to remember their names, all that you can recall is the names of your high school buddies or classmates for some odd reason. Does that ring a bell?
It happens to me a lot. Remembering people's names, you have to at least introduce yourself three times. To me before I actually remember what your name is. But I've also always wondered rather why I've always remember the irrelevant things, and sometimes not the information needed for my exam at times. But how are they able to find this out, this interesting data?
You're a special case. I need to say that firstly. Right. But a research professor of biology at the Institute for Neuroscience at the California Institute of Technology called Caltech, Carlos Lois, was used actually a mouse model to determine the strong, stable memories that are encoded by teams of neurons all firing in synchrony, providing redundancy that enables these memories to persist over time.
That's interesting. So do you suppose we can look further into research, into implications of understanding how memory might be affected after brain damage in the case of a stroke, Alzheimer's disease or dementia?
Well, the team developed a test to examine the mice's neural activity as they learn about and remember a new place. And in the test, a mouse actually was placed in a narrow enclosure about 1.5 meters within white walls. And unique symbols were marked at different locations along the walls. For instance, a bold plus sign near the rightmost end and an angled slash near the center. Then a reward of sugar water was placed at either ends of the track for the mice. So the researchers actually measured the activity of specific neurons in the mouse's hippocampus, the region of the brain where new memories are formed, known for encoding places as the mouse explores.
Okay, cool. But how does this inform them about what old memories the mouse had before being exposed to the new ones?
When the mouse was initially placed in the track, it was unsure of what to do. You can imagine, I mean, right? You're just placed in the middle of nowhere, right?
Exactly.
And you're expected to figure your way out. So it wondered about going left and right until coming across the reward. Then when this happened, single neurons were activated when the mouse took notice of a symbol on the wall. But over multiple experiences within the track, the mouse became very familiar with those those marks and remembered the locations of the sugar. As the mouse became more and more familiar, more and more neurons were activated by seeing each symbol on the wall. Yep, so they came back to the mouse, the memories.
So in essence, the mouse recognized its location with respect to its each unique symbol on the wall. But I have not heard the part explaining what happens when we trade new memories with old one. What's up with that?
To study how memories fade over time, postdoctoral scholar Walter Gonzalez then withdrew the mice from the trek for 20 days. And upon their return after his long break, mice that had formed strong memories encoded by higher numbers of neurons remembered the task quite easily. Even though some neurons showed different activity, the mouse's memory on the track was clearly identifiable when analyzing the activity of large groups of neurons.
So you mean that using groups of neurons enables the brain to be idle and still recall memories, even if some of the original neurons fall silent or are damaged?
Right, very right. Let's just say you have a long distance marathon to run, right?
Right.
Yeah. But along the route, you would have to take detours because of roadworks and obstacles along the way. Now, in order to beat your last score, you would need to be privy to information of what kind of obstacles lay ahead, and you'd need to find better ways, right?
Right.
So you'd need something like a navigation map or an updated GPS. Right.
Of course.
Now, in addition to that, next time you run along that route, instead of taking a GPS, you place markers along the route to help you access those routes far easily without you flinching or being confused by the tech. This way, the markers help preserve and strengthen your memory, just like the GPS and the markers. And then these neurons actually help each other out to encode memories that will persist over time.
But it is unfortunate that it does not normally happen the way it does it? Because if it did, then why do we forget important things? Like, for instance, you think of making another cup of coffee, you stand up, make your way to the kitchen. When you get there, you find a spill on the floor, which distracts you.
Yeah.
And then you end up spending 5 minutes or so standing in the middle of the kitchen, trying to figure out the reason for going into the kitchen in the first place.
I must really say, your memory problem are many, but I know of many people that this has happened to before. However, remember with age, diseases such as Alzheimer's can affect one's memory capacity, because a memory is encoded by fewer neurons, and if any of these neurons fail, the memory is then lost. So this study suggests that one day designing treatments could boost the recruitment of higher numbers of neurons to encode a memory, which could help prevent memory loss.
So then there is light at the end of the tunnel for those experiencing memory loss, like myself.
Yeah. Conventional theories about memory storage assume that making a memory more stable requires the strengthening of the connections to an individual neuron. And results from this study suggest that increasing the number of neurons that encode the same memory enables memory to persist for far much longer. How do you think about that?
I think it's pretty good research and technology. If they could try it on humans, then probably we're in for a good run.
Yeah, but they need to really run a few tests.
Can
really.
I be the first person they try it out?
They're guinea
my
pig.
Short memory.
Oh, well, that was Unusual, Unlikely, Unscience. And this week's science was sourced from sciencedaily.com, and the music is by Mos Def.
This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back. You're still with the Science Inside, and we are in conversation with Thulile Khanyile. And in her research, she is working on a vaccine that will mimic cells of the HIV virus, which cannot infect the person, but definitely eliminate the creation or the duplication of more cells, and ultimately treat the body, and so that the body can actually respond to or against the virus cells. And this is really impressive work. And if I may add, this will also lessen the burden on the public health sector, where we know that, you know, South Africa is really burdened with the virus epidemic. Now we get a little bit more comfortable and up close and personal with Thulile. Welcome back, Thulile.
Yes.
Now, Thulile, we also spoke to your mom, Umam Ndomfuti Khanyile, and this is what she had to say about you.
we wanted her to have a stable job, you know. We are from the old school of thought, you see, where we think ukuthi if umntwana ends a academic or it's medicine or education or something like that, then she will get a job and have a stable life, you see. So that's why we wanted her to be a medical doctor, you know. Yeah, what we do with our kids, we support them in whatever they choose to do. Ngesikhathi esifika eVisits of Pretoria, why said no, akazi ukwenza medicine because it will take her too long to have money, you see. At first, she didn't qualify. She had to do a BSc, but at the end of the day, is one which immense other medical doctor. But then she said, no, 7 years. No, I can't. We are so near Bakura Sabantabata, we are so near Usabenza Ganzima, Umtawake. Yena Agasielum Dana Ozuti, upright, but she's a hard to work. Whatever she sets her mind, whatever she wants to do, she works hard towards achieving the things that she wants.
Now, Chilile, we heard your mother saying you're a go-getter, you're an achiever, as in you can't be stopped. What is your response to that? Is that true?
I think it's always really interesting to me. And it's always, I think, really humbling to hear your parents speak about you in that manner. I think it's really humbling. And she sounds like she's proud of the person I've become, and that's really humble, humbling, and I'm just really lost for words, to be honest.
Yeah, she actually did say she's very proud.
No, she's so cute. My mom's lovely.
Yeah, she is a lovely woman. But you grew up in Etiquini. What were the unique challenges that you faced up, especially what kind of the challenges, the unique challenges that young people face there?
The unique challenges that young people face there now, that they faced then.
Mm.
Or are you talking about now?
Well, at the time when you were growing up there, and then you sort of just looked at the circumstances and then you said to yourself, no, this is how I want to forge my life forward.
I think if I must be honest with you, I think that my parents raised me in a way that sort of occupied my time.
Mm.
My time was occupied. So I was at school and I played sports and I was doing this or doing that. So my honest view of how young people were will be those that I was at school with.
Yeah.
And the ones that were in my class were very driven young people, they were very competitive. And the ones that were not in my class were perhaps engaged in other things. They found other things interesting. So they found partying interesting. They found boys and getting into relationships interesting. Perhaps not necessarily engaging themselves in planning for their futures. They also saw a lot of people when they're in high school don't think about what life must look like after university. And I think I occupied myself and the people that were in my class, we occupied ourselves a lot about on what I wanted every day to look like for me.
Yeah.
After university, what did I want every day to look like? And I just felt like other people were serious about it and there were other things that they were interested in and I didn't understand why they were interested in those things. So others would fall pregnant. And obviously at school, the academic careers, you know, and people are concerned with, I just felt like people were concerned with other things that I didn't think they should be concerned with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a very busy woman. You've got many things that you need to get to, but you also use a lot of lists. As I had read in one of the articles, you use lists to get through some of the tasks that you need to do for the day. Mm-hmm. But what pushes you and motivates you without, you know, making you feel overwhelmed?
I think for me, it's people. I think people inspire me a lot. How the mind of a person works, the potential that a person has. People inspire me. I get inspired by people. I spend a lot of time interacting with people of different ages, from different backgrounds. And for me, that inspires me, and it pushes me to want to be better all the time. The other thing, I think, is that as a scientist, you sort of, as a scientist, the value of being a scientist is how science teaches you to think, and the questions that you ask as a scientist, which lead to more questions and lead to more questions. So that desire to want to answer the next question is also quite a big driver. So if you look at the world right now and you look at the number of challenges that we have, what you want to find out is why we have those challenges. And as long as there's a why, I want an answer. Whether I'm the person finding the answer or the person equipping other people to be able to find those answers. But I just want to keep understanding and finding the answers. And where there are more questions, I want to know what those questions are. I think that people and just the desire to understand things,
yeah,
find answers.
And since you've spoken about, you know, interacting with people being your biggest motivator, being something that really pushes you forward, you also have Nkatuto, where you also interact with young people. Not only do you interact with young people here at the university as a lecturer, but at the NPO as well. Can you share some of your success stories through this NPO that you started not so long ago?
So I think right now our most successful, what I would say is our biggest achievement right now, is that we have kids in townships who believe and know that their ideas are valuable and they're commercializable and they can change the world. And I think for me, on a philosophical level, That's our biggest success to date, and continues to be. I think will continue to be the success as long as we have increasing numbers of these kids that participate in the program.
Yeah.
From a technical perspective, it is that the Technology Innovation Agency TIA, through its Grassroots Innovators Program, which identifies innovators at a grassroots level who identify problems and create technology-based solutions, then they fund them. And typically, those are out-of-school-going people. But when we looked at their clause closely, we realized that they actually don't exclude kids. So we entered some of the solutions that our kids were coming up with in the program, and we entered three. And all three of them are successful in getting funding for product development. So right now, I think our biggest success is that we're beginning to realize the possibility of economic value from ideas and solutions that these kids are coming up with in the township schools and in the rural communities.
In 2018, you were named 100 most influential young people in South Africa. What was that experience like?
Sure, that was so that was excuse me. Sorry, I still don't know how to feel about that. It's still somewhat an out of body experience of sorts, and I'll tell you why, because most of the time when you get something, an honor of this nature, you know that you're going to get it.
Mm.
They tell you that, oh, okay, you know, congratulations, you've been named the whatever. With Avance, they don't do that. They just release, there's a media release that says these are the people that have been voted for. You don't know who voted for you. You don't know. Sometimes you don't even know that it was going on and there was a voting process.
Yeah.
So for me, that was like, it was incredible because I didn't have to tell anyone what I did. I didn't have to write anything. No one had to call me and say, I want to nominate you for this. Can you give me your CV? It is one of those where someone puts a name out and people vote.
Yeah.
So it sort of says that people already know the work that I do without me having to tell them. And I thought that for me was, I don't actually have the word for it. It's one of those where you realize that bigger powers exist and there are certain things that are out of your control and will happen whether you intervene or not.
Yeah.
They will happen. You know what I mean?
Mm. And
yeah, so that was awesome.
Wow, that is really incredible. Just very briefly, what would your parting words be to your students and other young people in your field or in the science field who may be listening to the show tonight? What would your parting words be?
So I'm very passionate about the way that scientists and engineers and technologists think, but I am concerned about the lack of an entrepreneurial mindset within that population of people when we live in a time where economies are growing as a result of the development of technology. So if I had to say anything to young people that are in the STEM field, I would say to them, concern yourself with the art of developing an entrepreneurial mindset so that you can grow your value, grow the value of your community and grow the value of the country and the continent. Think bigger than the perpetuating and think bigger than the algorithm and think bigger than the code, you know, or the program.
Yeah.
Think bigger than that and think about the value that you can create using the skill set that the university teaches you.
Hmm. Those are really impressive words and very inspiring. I thank you so much for being on The Science Inside and taking your time out to speak to us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, then. There was Thulile Khanyile, who is a lecturer and a social entrepreneur, and she's a lecturer here at the Witwatersrand University. And this was us here on The Science Inside giving a platform to young scientists who are working really hard, who are making changes and who are innovative. And we were giving them just a platform to speak about their science. And we were talking just now with Thulile Khanyile, and her research she's working on a vaccine that mimics cells of the HIV virus, which cannot infect the person, but can eliminate the creation or duplication of cells, which will ultimately cure or heal the or eliminate the HIV virus from the body. And in tonight's On Science, we discovered how memories are made and how some old memories are much harder to get rid of, mostly than recent memories. And we concluded the show with personal moments from Thulile's life, where she spoke about her achievements and where she's going next in her career. But that was it on tonight's show. The team behind the scenes is production by Mulebohe Mukoka and tech by Kutlwano Serame. Our podcast can be found on podcastvits.journalism.co.za/science, and it can also be found on iTunes. The Science Inside is produced in part by the Wits Radio Academy and the South African Department of Science and Technology. That was it for tonight. Good night.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on The Science Inside.
The Science Inside Podcast.